We have with us live in the studios once again, Maria Tomczyk with Eat the State. Good morning.
Good morning.
Plenty to cover as usual, starting with the local and a new report out on the SPD.
Yeah, the federal monitor, Merrick Bob, who was appointed by the court to oversee changes at the SPD as part of Seattle's agreement with the Department of Justice over concerns with biased policing and the use of excessive force, he filed his semi-annual report this week on progress of police reforms at the SPD. And he said that for the most part, things are moving along, except he said that police commanders, a lot of the police commanders, are resisting reforms and that there are still pockets of resistance within the SPD to making substantial changes. In particular, he cited problems with the internal investigations of officer-involved shootings and the Firearms Review Board. He said that the procedures there really, and this is a direct quote, fall well short of a full, fair, and impartial analysis. Basically saying that it's not transparent how they come to their decisions and that it seems a lot of the time that the Firearms Review Board hides how they came to the decision that the officer didn't do anything wrong. So that there's a lot of work to be done there. That's no surprise. The SPD, he said, another area that he highlighted in his report, he said that the department's in-car camera procedures are a big problem, and that's not a new issue. That's an old issue. And this is another direct quote: "Video and audio are missing far too frequently." End quote. In incidents that come up for review, and I know that the department has undergone a couple of lawsuits by people who sued trying to get access to audio and videos of their arrests or of their incidents with SPD. And then in some cases, when the SPD told them they didn't have the audio and video, that the audio and video turned up later. And whether that it's hard to know. It's not clear if the problem is the lack of officers turning on the audio and video in the first place or if there are problems in the back end. My guess is there are problems in the back end. Something's happening to the recordings afterwards and it's hard to know what's happening to the recordings afterwards because there doesn't seem to be a good standards in place for logging and tracking the audio and video, making sure that it's kept for a certain period of time. The SPD seems to me that it's hard to know whether it's intentional that these things get lost afterwards or are erased afterwards, or if there are big shortfalls in that, like I say, that logging and tracking system. In any case, there's a lot of work to be done there, and the SPD hasn't been as quick on those reforms as they should be.
All right, so it's a semi-annual report. We can expect another one in another 6 months?
Another 6 months or so. This report, this is Merrick Bob's opinion. The SPD has about 30 days in order to respond to this, and then the court looks it over and decides whether or not to impose any sanctions on the SPD.
All right. Anything else on that?
No, let's move on.
All right. Different report coming out from Metro.
Yeah. King County Metro Bus Service, King County Metro Bus released their services guidelines report. They do this report about once a year, usually in the springtime. But this year they decided to move that report release date to the fall in order to help King County put together proposals for budgeting for transportation and for the Metro Bus Service. So they released that report earlier this month. It was reported by the Seattle Transit blog this week, which is where I saw it. I've been reading the Seattle Transit blog, which is turning out to be one of my favorite online reads. And I recommend it for people who want to know what's going on transit-wise and transportation-wise in Seattle. There were a couple of notable things this year in the Metro Service report. One of them is that system-wide reliability is only at 78.6%, which is far from stellar. That means about 20% of the time, a little over 20% of the time, or about one in every five rides, maybe a little more often, your bus is going to be either very late, very early so that you miss it, or it's going to not come at all, or it's going to be so packed with people you won't get a seat on it or even standing room. That's one in five rides, or a little more often, and that's a little too often to make a truly reliable system. Now, part of the reason for that, as Metro points out in its service guidelines report, is that demand has increased dramatically. And to address the overcrowding, and they use the word overcrowding, so Metro is aware of this problem and unreliability in the system, they say they need to add about 510,700 service hours in bus service. Now, I should note, too, that because of special funding for Metro service that's going to expire in June, Metro is going to have to undergo 17% cuts in service if nothing is done. That comes to about 600,000 service hours. So what they're really saying in this report is, instead of a 17% cut, what they need to do is they need to increase service by 15% just to address overcrowding and unreliability issues, or the system is going to become even more unreliable. And that's just to address today's demands. That's not to provide any capacity for an expansion of demand for bus service that may come in the next year or two or further out. Seattle is one of five U.S. cities where more people commute by bus, bike, walk, or carpool than drive their single passenger automobiles to work. So, you know, we need a bus system that reflects that kind of demand and that demographic change that is occurring. And we're not getting that. The state legislature has, that takes me into my next topic. The state legislature this year refused to call a fourth special session to pass a transportation package. Yes, that's right. There have been three special sessions so far this year, two of them early in the year after the regular session in order to get a budget deal passed. And one special session earlier this month was called by Governor Inslee to pass a $9 billion tax cut package for Boeing. So the state legislature and the governor can get together and say, yes, let's do a special session when Boeing snaps its fingers. But when it comes to the needs of folks who rely on Metro Transit bus service, when it comes to folks who are stuck in their cars on deteriorating roads and bridges in the state, the legislature and the governor can't agree to pass a transportation package. Now, Metro Transit had been hoping that the legislature would pass a transportation package that would include the ability to allow King County to increase the motor vehicle excise tax by 1.5% to pay for bus service. Since the legislature is not going to do that, King County officials came out and said, well, King County is going to do something to put together a transportation plan that involves the county council sitting down and taking a vote on a proposal, and that proposal would put a tax package to voters. What voters would be voting on would be the ability to create a transportation benefit district for King County that would then be able to collect have a county sales tax increase and a vehicle license tax fee that would raise money for Metro Transit service. The problem with a county sales tax is that it's regressive. Everybody pays a sales tax regardless of income. The same is true for the vehicle license tax fee. It's a flat fee. Everybody who owns a car has to pay the same fee, regardless of what your car's value is. The motor vehicle excise tax, on the other hand, that the legislature would approve, that one is scaled to the value of your vehicle, so it's much less regressive. So obviously that's the preferred option, but since that's not happening, the county council wants to put together this transportation benefit district. The other drawback for this plan is that it creates another layer of bureaucracy and, again, another layer of costs in there. So thank you, Republicans. I know the Republicans in the state legislature think that by starving funding for government programs, including bus service, that's good for I'm not sure why they think that's good, but they think that's good for America. Less, you know, that's the Republican ideology, less government overall. In this case, that's not what's happening. By starving Metro Transit of funds at the state level, it's creating another layer of bureaucracy. It's just expanding government in order to collect local taxes to support Metro Transit. And I also want to mention, too, meanwhile, the Amalgamated Transit Union Local 587, those are the Metro Transit Workers Union, is asking their members to approve a new 3-year contract that has a 1-year wage freeze in 2014. I don't know if that's going to fly because, you know, Metro Transit bus drivers have to support their families, too. But, also overcrowded buses and the unreliability of the system, the fact also that Metro has made some cuts to worker layover times has made being a Metro Transit driver not quite as much fun as it used to be. So I'm not sure that the workers will go for that. But, the union is trying at any case to do its part to help Metro Transit,
right,
even if the legislature's not.
Moving along then to national and filibuster. Yeah.
Yes, Monday Senate Republicans blocked the third nominee in the past month to the U.S. Federal Court of Appeals for Washington, D.C. That's the court that's second in stature to the Supreme Court in the nation. The Democrats, sick of the fact that the Republicans have filibustered most of President Obama's nominees, then voted to change the Senate's rules to eliminate the ability for the minority party to filibuster most presidential appointees. That's a big change. The filibuster rules were initially instituted in 1917 when Congress could not come to an end of debate to vote on most issues. They didn't have a way to end debate and to call for a vote if the minority party wanted to stall legislation. So they instituted a filibuster rule, a filibuster vote, saying that at any time the majority party could call for a vote to end discussion and start the actual vote on the legislation. But in order for that vote to end discussion to pass, they had to get what was then a supermajority of 67% of the members to vote yes to end discussion. Then later on, more recently, that number was changed, lowered to 60%. And so the 60% filibuster vote, now that we have pretty much almost 50-50 split of Democrats to Republicans in the Senate, that 60% majority is almost never reachable now. So the Democrats finally said, look, we're tired of this. You know, the president has not in the last 4.5 years been able to fully staff his executive branch. We can't get people appointed to the federal courts at all. We're going to end the filibuster for presidential appointees, with the one exception that Supreme Court candidates are still subject to filibuster. Filibuster can also still be used on legislation. So any new laws that come up for a vote can still be filibustered. Now, I just want to point out too, and I know it's been pointed out elsewhere, here it is. In the history of the U.S. government, there have been about 168 filibusters total. Half of them have come during President Obama's administration, just in the last 4.5 years. The number of presidential appointees that have not been confirmed that are still hanging out there is massive. And it's really time. There are 59 executive branch positions and over 17 federal court positions that are sitting vacant because the Republicans just think that it's okay to not staff the government. Now, Democrats have been saying that the Republicans can't accept that Obama won a second term, and that's the reason why they're not allowing these appointments to go through. But really, it's because the Republicans couldn't accept that Obama won a first term. You know, it's been 4.5 years, folks. You got to let these appointees take their jobs. Added to that is the Republican ideology, like I mentioned earlier, that getting rid of big government is important. And one way to do that, one way to force that to happen, is to force them to force these agencies to de-staff or not appoint the managers that are needed to run these different federal agencies. So if the government doesn't function well, then the people will hate it. And, of course, it will be a lot easier for the Republicans to dismantle it even further. So defund it is one way to do it, and de-staff it is the other. That's the Republican ideology. And of course, that brings me to the next topic on our list, which is healthcare.gov. Now, one thing, while the Republicans have been masterful in their control of the media attention paid to healthcare.gov, they've been really pushing that healthcare.gov is the website has been failing, Obamacare is failing, you know, all these people are losing their health insurance plans that they loved, blah, blah, blah. They're not taking responsibility for their share of the problem, which is, and this has not been covered at all in the media, that clearly no one competent was overseeing the entire project of setting up healthcare.gov. That's the big picture that we're getting from the investigations into the setup of the healthcare exchange website, the National Healthcare Exchange website, is that people were working on individual pieces. And there were plenty of people who were warning that there are problems with the system, that we're having trouble getting our piece to work with another company's piece, et cetera. But there was no person really overseeing how it was all put together and making sure that everything synced up. And you have to ask, why is that the case? Well, think about it. If the Obama administration can't get its top managers appointed to the positions in the executive branch, well, it's pretty clear that the people who are there are over, you know, at the top levels are overworked trying to do multiple things, may not get to it, you know? So clearly the Republicans share some blame in this by filibustering all of these different appointees for the Obama administration. It's creating too much work for the people who are in higher office there in the executive branch. Now, I'm not the only person pointing this out. People who have worked in the first Obama administration pointed this out. Timothy Geithner, he didn't actually come out and say this explicitly, but he hinted at this many times while he was Treasury Secretary, that it was tough to do his job when he didn't have top-level assistants to help him. He was understaffed at all, you know, during his entire time at Treasury. And I'm sure Hillary Clinton, if people really ask her outright, she would confirm that it was tougher to do her job because she didn't have top-level assistants helping her out. You got to believe Kathleen Sebelius is in that same position at Health and Human Services, trying to oversee this healthcare.gov website. So that's something that's not being pointed out in the media. Okay. Also, in terms of the healthcare rollout, I want to talk about. I know last week I talked a little bit about the media's attention on people who were losing insurance losing the insurance that they liked under the old system and having to take on new policies. And I talked a little bit about crappy policies that only cover catastrophic events. And since last week's show, we've gotten a lot of emails and I've gotten a lot of contact from people who say they like their crappy policies. I just want to point out that our old system of healthcare has been so bad that Americans have gotten used to what I think is, and what a lot of doctors would agree, third world style healthcare, third world standard of healthcare. And that includes these catastrophic policies. A lot of these catastrophic policies don't cover very basic things that we should have access to in a first world industrialized country. Things like routine physicals that include blood tests for cholesterol levels and blood sugar screenings, mammograms for every woman. Every single woman who reaches the age of 40 should have a baseline mammogram. That's not the case in the United States, and that's a scandal. Every person who reaches the age of 50 should have colon cancer screening. That's not the case in the United States, and that's a scandal. Prostate cancer screening, skin cancer screening, prescription drug coverage. Many, many catastrophic policies do not include prescription drug coverage. And I have to tell you, in a day and age, in the modern era, with the amount of drug-resistant bacteria that we have floating around out there, you can get one infection and it can take 3, 4, even 5 different prescriptions until you find the one that kills the infection, that cures your infection. And that can wipe out your life savings right there. One skin infection, for example, that's resistant to drugs. So you need to have these things. and vision coverage, a dental plan. I mean, these things are all part of a first world healthcare system. And we've just gotten so used to having a third world level of healthcare that people are defending their crappy, catastrophic policies. And I find that both sad and a little bit infuriating, because when people get sick and they have only catastrophic coverage, if they can't pay for their health care, the rest of us end up paying for it in higher doctor fees, in higher hospital bills, in higher health insurance premiums. So people do need to give up their cheaper, crappy policies that they love, and they need to pony up for a real first world health care coverage.
Yeah. I got a shirt that I heart my crappy health care.
It's a change in thinking. You have to think, okay, just because I'm relatively healthy doesn't necessarily mean that you're not going to get sick in the future. If you do get sick in the future, you got to have that coverage, you know?
All right. Moving on. J.P. Morgan.
Yeah, this week, a historic penalty for J.P. Morgan. The Department of Justice won a $13 billion civil settlement from J.P. Morgan, the first big civil settlement that the Department of Justice has won from a big bank over the questionable mortgage practices from 2005 to 2008. It's over the subprime and Alt-A mortgages made by not just J.P. Morgan, but the two companies that J.P. Morgan bought, Bear Stearns and Washington Mutual. Now, of that, I just want to specify what that $13 billion includes. It includes $4 billion that will go to struggling homeowners. About half of that $4 billion will reduce principal on mortgages that are in foreclosure-damaged neighborhoods in places like Detroit and New York City. The other $2 billion will reduce interest rates on existing loans and or go into new loans for low-income buyers. The other $9 billion of the settlement, $2 billion of that is a fine that's going to be paid to Sacramento, California. $7 billion will go to compensate the federal agencies and state attorney generals who were part of the lawsuit in areas heavily hit by the foreclosure crisis. That includes places like Illinois, New York, California, et cetera. Now, I just also want to point out, too, that $13 billion is about half of J.P. Morgan's annual profit. So last year, J.P. Morgan made about $26 billion. $13 billion is about 6 months' profit for them. Not 6 months' revenue, 6 months' profit off the top that would ordinarily go to shareholders. Now, J.P. Morgan, Washington Mutual, and Bear Stearns all together, from about 2004 to 2007, they issued about $1 trillion in mortgages of the type that we're talking about here, subprime and Alt-A mortgages. Now the $13 billion settlement then is about, if you look at that, that's about, you know, a little over 1%, maybe 2% of that $1 trillion. Now you better believe that those banks did not make only 1% to 2% profit on those mortgages, or they wouldn't even have bothered to issue them. Their profits were far, far higher than the $1 trillion. They're far, far higher than that, than those $1 trillion would indicate. And so $13 billion really is only a drop in the bucket in terms of a penalty for J.P. Morgan. Now, also, people have pointed out, too, that when you impose financial penalties like this on a big company, especially 5 years after the fact, you know, you're really just punishing the current shareholders of the company. In addition, I want to point out that you're not just punishing the current shareholders of the company. You're really rewarding the current management, because a relatively small fine like this is making the current management look good, because they negotiated a great deal from the U.S. government. What is really called for here are criminal cases that put people behind bars. And it's 5 years after the fact. Any criminal cases that have been filed are still working their way through the courts. You're bumping up against things like difficulty in getting the evidence together 5 years after the fact. And also, those criminal cases are going to have to rely on people's memories 5 years out, and that's going to be a tough thing to do. So just like most other Americans, I would really like to see some people do jail time for this. But we're just 5 years out now getting the first big civil settlements. That's pretty pathetic, I think.
All right. Moving on, jobless benefits.
Yeah, amongst the other things that that Congress has not gotten to, like an agriculture bill and an immigration policy bill, or a renewal of food stamp benefits for folks whose food stamp benefits expired earlier this month. Congress is also going to be letting jobless benefits expire. They have approximately 1 week to pass legislation, and I doubt that they will get to it. 1.3 million people will lose immediate access to unemployment benefits at the end of December, and about 850,000 more will lose benefits in 2014. And that's just the folks who are working. It doesn't include all of their children who will be affected by their parents' loss of unemployment benefits. Congress, as I said, adjourns at the end of the week. They're not even looking at a bill to renew unemployment benefits, which the extension of unemployment benefits were first voted in 2008 in the midst of the recession and have been renewed regularly ever since then by Congress. But apparently this Congress could not agree. The Congressional Budget Office, I want to say, has also called the extension of unemployment benefits one of the most effective programs for stimulating the economy because it puts money into the pockets of people who will spend it and will spend it all.
Right. And Walmart.
Walmart was recently investigated by the National Labor Relations Board, and they found in their investigation that Walmart did illegally fire employees who went on strike during last year's Black Friday protests, which were organized by a group called Our Walmart, representing Walmart employees who are paid what they say are substandard wages, and I would certainly agree with that. They organized protests at over 1,000 Walmart stores in 46 states. Some of those employees were fired at some of those Walmarts, and the NLRB board agreed with that and said that that was a violation of workers' rights under the National Labor Relations Act. And then they authorized the filing of a complaint regarding those violations. Now, Walmart workers have not yet filed a complaint because they are currently negotiating with Walmart, but a complaint may be coming. And I want to remind people, too, that this Black Friday, this coming Friday, there will be more protests at Walmarts around the nation. And if you want to find out where those protests are going to be, you can go to a website called BlackFridayProtests.org. Just type in your zip code and see which Walmart or Sam's Club near you will be having a protest.
Yeah, BlackFridayProtests, plural.org. All right. Can you squeeze in 30 seconds or thereabouts
sure.
about Bangladesh?
Sure. U.S. and European retailers, a little bit of good news, have agreed on a joint inspection program for Bangladesh garment factories. The program was developed with the assistance of the ILO, the International Labor Organization, and the Bangladesh University of Engineering and Technology. It would require sprinkler systems in large buildings over 8 stories, stricter standards for fire alarms, and it would require fire doors between exit stairwells and production floors. Most of all, U.S. and European retailers have agreed to do thorough inspections of all their contractors and I hope subcontractors' factories by next summer. Now, there will be some money to make safety upgrades. The European companies will pay directly for those. However, U.S. companies said that they will only provide low-interest loans, like the blood-sucking scum that we Americans are. And in addition, European companies have agreed to provide some compensation for the victims of the Rana Plaza building collapse that happened in April and last year's Tazreen factory building fire. But the U.S. companies who bought garments from the contractors in those buildings have said that they will not give cash compensation to the victims. Those companies include Walmart, Children's Place, and Sears. Another good reason to join those Walmart protests next Friday.
Events.
Yeah, a couple of events. As I said, Friday, the 29th, there will be protests at Walmart. So, as I said, go to BlackFridayProtests.org and type in your zip code and find out where to go to support Walmart workers. Also, today, There is a Cranksgiving, which is a bicycle scavenger hunt to benefit the Rainier Valley Food Bank. Bicycle around to different grocery stores to pick up items to help the Rainier Valley Food Bank. That starts at 10:30 a.m. at Gasworks Park and ends in Columbia City. It's free, but you should bring about $20 for food donations, or a little bit more if you feel like really working up a sweat and carrying more food to the Rainier Valley Food Bank.
Talking as we do every week with Maria Tomczyk, co-editor at what used to be at The State. Where can people find Eat the State?
You can find back issues and occasionally new articles at www.eatthestate.org.